Welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selena Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pavitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship, and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Project Love podcast. It's Vicky here, the love coach of the duo, and I have such a fascinating episode to share with you today. I got to speak to Margie Kerr and Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie about their new book, Why Pain Hurts and Why It Doesn't Have To. In this episode, we talk about why pain isn't all bad and how we can develop a healthy relationship with it. We talked about resilience as a skill, something that we can practice and cultivate over time. Why we need to come up with more words to describe pain, why we need a bigger vocabulary for it, because one word is used to describe so much. We talked about heartbreak and why it hurts so much, and how we can support our loved ones when they are in pain, plus a whole lot more. I was really interested in the different experiences of pain and heartbreak in the context of romantic relationships. I gave two examples in the episode, although due to audio quality reasons, that question can't be heard. And so I'm just setting the context by giving you the two examples here. The examples I gave were the pain of being ghosted on a dating journey to the pain of navigating the end of a 10-year relationship. Now, these are both very different examples of pain and heartbreak, and it was really interesting to learn about the ways that context shapes our experience of pain. I learned so much from this episode. It was such a fascinating conversation that I had with Margie and Linda. I really hope you enjoy it. Here it is. Linda and Margie, a huge welcome to the podcast. How are you both doing today?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah, doing all right. Surviving homeschool. So thanks for providing an opportunity to do something else today. It's not trying to teach my children.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So good to have you on. And I'm really excited to talk to you about your new book. It's called Ouch, Why Pain Hurts and Why It Doesn't Have To. I would love to know more about this. I'd love for you to just tell us more about the book and how you both came to write it.
Well, I guess, Linda, I can start this one off with the kind of the foundings of it. I was just finishing up my first book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear, and knew that I wanted to keep the ball rolling with this idea of finding positivity and in what most consider, you know, negative states like fear and pain. And I also was really just left with a lot of questions because in my research of fear, I was struck with how often pain is used in the study of fear. So in the lab, whenever, researchers are doing things like fear conditioning or just studying, you know, our threat response, they use pain, some sort of, you know, thermal kind of discomfort or electrical stimulation. And I had that moment of thinking, well, fear and pain are not the same thing. I mean, they do work through similar, arousal systems, our sympathetic nervous system. But, you know, there's so many things in life that we call painful that don't overlap with what we would maybe call, you know, scary. So I really wanted to dive into that and find the ways that pain, you know, isn't all bad. I'm a sociologist by training. I'm not, you know, the most, you know, best writer in the world. And so it was really,
he's very good. That's
not true. So I wanted to team up with somebody and really write this collaboratively, because pain is so subjective that, you know, I think it does, benefit from having lots of different viewpoints. And so, I was familiar with Linda because of her work writing on why clowns are scary for the Smithsonian, I think, back in 2013. Yes. And yeah. I was like, now this is a person after my own heart. I need to talk to her. So I reached out and we started talking and discovered so many similarities. And that was kind of the origin. We just kind of took it from there.
I mean, when Margie reached out to me to work on this project, it was immediately fascinating. And I think one of the things that we found sort of through the course of us talking about it, and then in general, when we started reporting on this, is that, you know, everybody has a story about pain. Everybody has a relationship to pain in some way. But it's not a relationship that we tend to talk about very often. Now, we're happy to talk about stories of pain. Like I, you know, especially like I, at the time had, was I pregnant? I might've been pregnant. I don't remember. That's really sad. I can't remember that. But I definitely had one child and had recently done childbirth, that thing, the childbirth thing. And I think I had just done, yeah, I think Edwin was born by then. So, you know, I had had these two very painful experiences, and those tend to be experiences that women really talk about a lot. Like we talk about it, but we don't talk about it. It's a sort of strange thing. Like everybody's got their sort of birth story. And so you're kind of fresh from that experience and the recognition that we all have these kinds of stories about incidents where we were feeling hurt and in pain, but that they weren't always the same thing. And there was such a sort of huge breadth that encompassed that word pain. You know, that pain is this thing that it's such a flexible word that we use to apply so many different states, that we really, there's just a lot there to get into. And so this book about how the experience of pain is created, really dives into all of the ways that this experience is sort of worked upon by context and by what we want, our motivations, all those kinds of things. And it was just really, I mean, it was such a fascinating thing to work on. And I have to say, like, this is a hopefully a brief aside, but somebody posted on Facebook a question recently about the four books that you were most affected by this year. And one of them was, what book changed your behavior? And I felt like it was a real cheat, but I honestly had to respond that our book was the one that had changed our behavior, my behavior the most, because it really has impacted the way I think about pain and the way I sort of conduct myself now as a person.
Oh, tell me more about that. In what ways?
Well, I mean, I think the most immediate way is that I have found myself more capable of things than I thought I could be in the past. Mm-hmm. And in particular, as part of sort of the journey of this book and our working on this book, I decided that I wanted to have an experience with pain that was kind of ongoing, that was something that I could kind of work with. And I, you know, I'm not going to have another child. I like them at all, but don't want to do that again. And, you know, I don't want a tattoo. I don't want all these sort of things that I was thinking. And so I settled on a sport. And so I went from doing pretty much no sport at all to doing quite a lot more activity than I have been in the past. And so I run and I swim. And actually this, hopefully all things going well, I will hopefully be doing a channel relay swim this summer. And sort of as a part of doing this book, I swam Lake Coniston. So I've been doing a lot of things like that. I joined an athletic club and I've been running cross country. And all of those things have sort of made me realize that what I thought I was capable of wasn't what I was actually capable of. And that my relationship to my body was something that I could affect a lot more and change a lot more and do positive things with than I had previously really considered. And in particular, with regard to pain and discomfort, this is not to say that I, you know, want to sort of seek out and be in pain quite a lot, but that like I'm able to think about that experience in a way that is, I think, useful and helps me get through that experience. And in the context of running longer or swimming longer, mostly longer, and through very cold temperatures, it's helped me do that better. So that's one of the sort of big ones. And then at the same time, in other sort of circumstances and with regard to sort of how I have managed kind of painful circumstances and painful situations, and being able to recognize what's good pain and what's bad pain, and being able to sort of make a decision about when I'm going to need help. So one of the things that has happened recently is that I've been experiencing a lot of back pain and a lot of hip pain related to running. And whereas before I would either like just quit running altogether or would be like, it's fine, I'll just push through. Instead, I've actually decided to seek help for this. So that's actually a big step for me to actually go to a physio or a doctor. So So that's kind of the big thing for me, is that it's made me recognize that I am more capable of managing pain, and that it's not something that needs to or has to rule my experience of life.
It sounds like it's about resilience. Is that what you found in writing the book, that in developing this healthier relationship with pain, that it helps us to be more resilient?
I would say certainly for me. And I think, Margie, you've had some really sort of really interesting experiences with this. Yeah. Even since we've written the book, that, you know, I would say yes for me, that one of the things that I learned about myself is that emotionally, as well as sort of what we think of classically physically in pain, I feel like I know more and am better able to bounce back or to manage those situations, or learn how to figure out what I need to do to help myself manage those situations better. But Margie, you've definitely had a lot of experiences with that since then.
Yeah, it was funny. When I started writing the book, it was very much from the perspective of, you know, oh, I'm tough. You know, I grew up riding horses, playing roller derby, and had lots of, you know, bruises and broken bones and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, pain isn't so bad. Pain is totally manageable. And then we started writing the book, and I woke up one morning and was in intense pain. And it turned out that I had a pinched nerve, but also degenerative joint disease. And I ended up, you know, getting my C5 and C6 fused in 2016. And so I went from being very much kind of, you know, I am a strong, powerful woman, to being like, oh my God, you know, I can't function. I can't make it through a day without being in intense pain. And learning that nerve pain is so different, is such a different experience than any other types of pain. And it's so pervasive, just, you know, when your nerves are screaming, it's just feels so impossible to get away from. And so that really opened my eyes to a completely different side of pain. And for a lot of the time that we were writing the book, I was really struggling with, you know, how can I embody what we're writing about, you know, and how can I actually try and really use some of these skills, and constantly waking up and feeling like, oh, I can't do this. My body isn't doing what I want it to anymore. I'm not strong. I lost a lot of strength in my arm, and feeling pretty defeated. And, you know, I think because we were writing this book, I was able to kind of come through that and now be on the other side of it, where I'm back to being physical and running and, you know, newly invested in trying to take care of myself. But, you know, my mindset from when we started writing to when we finished just evolved just so, so completely. And in a way, I'm glad for the experience, because it did give me, I think, a lot more insight into chronic pain and, you know, the kinds of pain that result from our nervous system just going haywire, and you know, also gaining insight into the lifelong kind of struggles with finding that balance with your body and listening to it, and also knowing that sometimes, you know, my arms are just, they're still going to hurt, my neck is still going to hurt, but I have to keep moving and have to keep you know, just keep going. So yeah, it was, in terms of resiliency, a big thing we talk about is how it's a skill, but it's something that you practice. It's not something that you either have or don't have. It is something that you can cultivate over time. And so I constantly am reminding myself of that.
I also think, like, one of the things that really stood out to me in working through this and all the sort of various experiences that you have with your body, is that sense of when your body's in pain, almost sometimes feeling betrayed by that, and that frustration that these are the things that I want to be able to do, and now I can't because of this pain, because of my back, because of my hip, because of whatever. And I have really tried to work on and kind of internalize some of the things that we've talked about in this book, that your body isn't separate from you. It's not even your partner. It is you. You are your body. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I think growing up, you know, hearing, for example, my mom, you know, if she would gain weight, she'd be like, well, my body's just mad at me right now. Or she would have these sort of conversations where it was almost as if her body was not her, was just a different entity altogether. And one of the things that writing this book really did for me was to help remind me that you are your body, that it is you. There's not a real distinction between a quote emotional state and a physical state. This, it's all there. It is all part of you. And recognizing that has, I think, helped me be able to take better care of myself as in a more holistic way.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that the body communicates with us, and there's so much wisdom to be found in how the body communicates with us. And I think pain is probably the most effective way it does. Do you find that when it comes to physical pain, that it's an invitation to look at the pain from different perspectives? So like, you know, emotionally, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the big messages that you know, based on the most recent kind of understanding of how our nervous system is organized, is that, you know, we're responsible for making sense of all of these sensations. So, you know, when we experience a sensation, we do have the ability to come in and say, okay, well, what is this? Where is it coming from? Is it really, you know, associated to imminent damage or real damage? Can I, you know, reinterpret what this sensation is? Maybe think of it more as an intense, you know, soothing sensation, but the reframing and the reappraisal of our sensations is really something that I think we can do more than we maybe think we can. We do have more of a say in our emotional experiences. And you know, in the book, we do talk about how pain is an emotion. You know, it is a meaning that we're bringing to a physical experience. And, you know, our emotions based on affect, on what's happening in our body is giving rise to those feelings. And then it's up to us to kind of make sense of them. So pain is great at doing that, at inviting that conversation of, okay, what are you saying? And can I make you say something else? Can I redefine what this is? Or do I need to really stop and, you know, call a doctor or just, you know, do something else? But it is a way of learning to build that better connection between, you know, the signals coming in from the outside and the inside, and deciding what we want it to mean.
And pain also tends to be kind of the loudest voice in the room. And that's sort of a necessary function, right? I mean, it's, you know, when your body, when you are about to sort of experience imminent damage, or if there's going to be tissue damage, if there's going to be a real problem, or if there is already a problem that is happening, you know, you need to know about it quickly to stop it or change it. So that's why pain tends to be this kind of very loud signal. But oftentimes what can get lost in that signal is sort of what's really happening. And it definitely pays to sort of take a beat and feel that pain and know what it is before running to the paracetamol bottle to stifle it, or or any other thing to sort of muffle it down. It is an important opportunity to sort of let that pain exist for a minute and figure out what it's actually trying to say to you.
I think that the big message is to really kind of think about what is happening in your body, and that comes through experience, but to also challenge pre-existing relationships with pain. So much of our experience of pain is based on our previous experience. So, you know, if we go to the doctor and we have to get a shot, and we, you know that it stung in the past, or we got a shot that left us with a really sore arm, then we're walking into that situation expecting pain. And it may not be painful. So, you know, we have to challenge those pre-existing relationships to build, you know, new patterns. And I think many of us will find that things that we expected to be painful are not as painful as we, you know, expect them to be. And it's evolutionarily speaking, you know, to our advantage to avoid anything that is suspected of being painful. But if we do that to the extreme, we end up restricting our activity so much, limiting what we're doing because we fear pain. And so much of pain is that fear of the experience. But when we actually, you know, do it, like Linda mentioned, we discover that we are capable of enduring so much more, and it's not as bad as we think. So, you know, it's the, you know, these signals are always a message, and they're something to listen to, but, you know, we should always be challenging kind of those previous relationships and testing out, you know, new approaches to managing it. Maybe, you know, instead of taking ibuprofen, going for a walk or stretching or doing something else and discovering that, oh, wow, that actually worked just as well. And I feel even better than if I had taken an ibuprofen.
And it's also, I think, about, you know, all of that, definitely. And recognizing that a lot of the experience of pain is created through the context. And, you know, mm-hmm. as Marty said, that context is our previous experiences. It's our motivations in the moment. It is how we are feeling in the moment. It's what we want. It's who we're with. It's all of those things. And part of what we wanted to do by calling attention to how much context has an effect on how we experience pain is to enable people to recognize that that means that we too have an ability to affect that experience of pain, that we don't always have to be, in some ways, the victims of this experience. We don't always have to be at the mercy of pain, but that we have opportunities, even within a painful moment, to find ourselves resilient and to be strong. I mean, even recent research has demonstrated that that smiling, or really more accurately, grimacing, using both your cheek muscles and the muscles around your eyes, can greatly impact the experience of pain. So when you're getting a shot, for example, or a jab, if you sort of grimace or you give the smiling with your eyes, it can lessen the impact of that jab. It can make you feel less pain. So, you know, we have, part of what we wanted to do with this book is to represent to people that you have options, and those options don't have to just be medicine or surgery or drugs or sort of what we tend to think of as the stuff that's going to take away the pain.
So let's talk about heartbreak, the pain of heartbreak and grief and loss. And I know that you know the science of this, the science behind heartbreak. Why does it hurt so much?
Well, you know, what's really amazing is that we do, you know, we are always kind of adapting to our social environment. And so the people that we love, they become part of how we're managing stress. They become a real part of how, you know, how we feel. So, you know, when we love someone, when, excuse me, someone has come to be such a big part of our lives and offer such support, we're adapting so that they, you know, are essentially providing that. They're providing a very real stress reduction, you know, intervention. So we come home and we're in the presence of a loved one and our stress just drops automatically without trying to do anything. It's just the presence of this other person is helping us feel better, is, you know, just calming us and helping us just get to a better spot. So when they're gone, that's a very real removal of this thing that was helping us manage our stress. And so that's felt in our body. So our stress, you know, stays high or it goes even higher because now something that was helping us manage stress before is gone. And that, you know, can start kind of an upward cycle of stress and anxiety, which then puts our body in a overtaxed mode. And when our body is taxed, we just feel worse. You know, we feel everything a little bit more intensely, including physical pain. Everything just is, you know, kind of more like a raw, exposed wire. And so the loss of people, the loss of loved ones does impact in such a real physiological, neurochemical way.
And I mean, we don't want to overstate the role of certain neurotransmitters or neurochemicals, because there is a tendency in reporting and talking about neurochemicals to sort of reduce each one to a specific thing, you know, oxytocin or dopamine, these things, oxytocin having been kind of labeled the love neurotransmitter, or dopamine having been labeled the reward hormone, like all of those sorts of things, isn't really quite accurate in terms of how they work as part of a system. You know, it's, it, they're, it's much, much more complicated than that. But it is useful in demonstrating that when something stressful happens to us, there are real neurophysiological changes that happen in our body that then produce, that can produce physical effects, including, you know, the pain and the anxiety that we feel. And we know this. I mean, one of the things that we encountered quite a lot in this book is people tending to place physical pain as somehow in a category as somehow more real than, quote, emotional pain. And lived experience could tell anybody that that's not the case. That one is more real than the other, or one is more, you know, hurtful or painful or any of those things than the other, and that they are in fact actually the same thing in a lot of ways. And so, you know, when something that is stressful, that is emotionally taxing happens to us, of course it's going to have an effect on the whole system in the ways that, I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, think about like when you're happy, you laugh. That's a physical reaction. When you're sad, you might cry. That's a physical reaction. These things happen to us all the time. And yet we sort of tend to place things that happen in the emotional category as somehow not as real as things that happen in the physical category.
You know, pain is an entirely subjective experience. It's something that we, you know, only know within ourselves. We can never know entirely someone else's pain, and everybody has different sensitivities, and it's really a variation is the norm. And so what's experienced as painful for me may be completely different for somebody else. And so we have this one word that tries to capture so much. And one thing we talk about a lot in the book is coming up with a bigger vocabulary to try and capture this wide range of experience, because pain, you know, it can't be reduced to a measure of something like nociceptive reactivity, which is the neurons that respond specifically to tissue damage, or muscle or bone damage, or nociceptors. But that's not the only thing that we can use to measure pain, because we don't even need real tissue damage for nociception to occur. So when we think about what pain is, it really is what we say it is. And so it then comes to, you know, issues of communication and really kind of getting more complex and appreciating the many, many layers to what's happening. And unfortunately, because of the way, especially in the US, our healthcare system is organized, there's this constant push to try and reduce pain to something that we can measure exactly the same from person to person and with even in the same person. But the truth is that we can't use this one word to define it with such a specific meaning. And the new definition released by the International Association of Pain reflects that complexity, that, you know, we do just have this one word that encompasses so much. But if we want to get down to like what a person is experiencing, we can start, you know, asking different kinds of questions that, you know, get to different types of revelations, like, oh, okay, your bone is broken, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be screaming in agony for 10 hours. We interviewed a lot of people, one who teaches kids acrobatics, and, you know, kids who are taught from a very early age to pay attention to the sensations, to, you know, be mindful about it, to think like, okay, I'm feeling a burning sensation, I'm feeling this, does it hurt, you know, to take some deep breaths. They come to have that really strong relationship with what's happening in their body, and then use a really diverse vocabulary. And we heard a story of, you know, a kid had broken his bone, but he didn't immediately, you know, start screaming and wailing and crying. He was like, I think that this is a bigger injury than usual. I think that this is serious. And so I think that, you know, it's important that, you know, from a young age, we start just broadening our vocabulary of how we talk about all these different sensations.
And that certainly applies to emotional, what we would consider sort of emotional states as well. And when it comes to, say, for example, a broken heart, I mean, looking at and examining the reasons why you might feel pain when somebody ghosts you versus the kind of pain that you will feel when you are going through divorce after 10 years, you know, it is important to dig down deep on all of those reasons behind them and the circumstances. And they, you know, we can't really sort of talk about equivalent pain because we don't know. We don't know what's going on or how deeply someone might be hurt when they're ghosted. You know, what's happening to them in their life in that moment that might make that act even more significant. You know, are they separated from the rest of their family? Are they separated from their friends? Are they feeling more isolated?
Is it the middle of a pandemic? Yeah.
Is it the middle of a pandemic? Exactly. You know, so all of those things that go into one experience, which is why it's really hard to say, you know, even when it comes to things that you might think you could quantify, like a broken arm, you know, you can't. It's very difficult to say my pain from my broken arm is the same as your pain from your broken arm, and that both of those measure a 3 on the level of on a scale of 1 to 10. And I think this, you know, it similarly applies with when we start talking about stuff that we sort of more classically consider emotional pain, breakups, grief, all of those kinds of things. When someone says something hurts, it hurts. And we need to respect that and really sort of get into what that might mean to them. And figure out all of the reasons around why. And it's, you know, it's something that like, that, that I try to do with my kids a lot, to, you know, some success and some less successful moments, but, you know, when they're upset with me, when they're angry, it's not just that they're angry, but to them, they just have this sort of, you know, red veil that goes down and they can't see through it. And all they can see is just they're angry, 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 and they just want to blow up the world. But if I'm helpful and if I'm in a place where I can also support them through this, which is few and far between these days, but I can help them name the stuff that's making them angry. Is it just anger or is it anger and hunger? Is it anger and sadness? Is it anger and frustration because they haven't been able to see their friends in weeks? Is it anger and social isolation? Do they feel like they are they sad because they haven't been able to see anybody and the only person they can play with is their brother and they don't want to play with them anymore because, you know, what is actually going on? So being able to name those sensations, drill down deeper into what they mean, and give them more, give these experiences a wider vocabulary and way to express them means that you can take better steps to dealing with them.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I was just thinking about how important compassion and mindfulness and reflection and all these themes that are a big part of my work as a love and dating coach, supporting clients and helping them to be more secure in love. It just feels like these themes are coming up in this conversation as well, like the importance of really, you know, checking in with yourself and meeting yourself where you are and leaning into the discomfort and not being so afraid of it and listening to the, you know, the messages from the body, listening to how we're feeling emotionally and get really specific about what it is that is really causing us pain to then be able to get the right help or support ourselves in the right way.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we really found that thinking of pain, that pain is an emotional experience. And as an emotional experience, we can consider it in the same way that we would sort of take care of our emotional selves. And that is, was for me, at least, an important recognition.
Yeah, we go into a lot of the recent research around interoceptive awareness and sensitivity and what it means to really be in tune with what's happening in your body, and how impactful that is on, you know, our physical well-being, emotional well-being, just our overall quality of life. There's been so much good research looking at how important it is to, as you said, lean into the discomfort too. You know, if we just continually restrict ourselves to things that feel good, eventually we'll be in a very tiny, small little, you know, probably on the couch, not leaving the house and not really feeling great. You know, we have to feel a lot of stuff, a lot of different things at different intensities so that We do have that greater kind of emotional diversity, and that's linked with all of these amazing health benefits. So it's not just to have a lot of emotional experiences. There's real benefits, real gains to be made from, you know, even leaning into the discomfort and confronting all of the tougher stuff, the negative feelings, and diving into the depths of sadness and grief and anger. And it's hard and uncomfortable, but it is associated with lots of great payouts and a greater connection, ability to connect with other people. Yes. To, you know, be more compassionate and more empathetic.
And exactly. And in thinking of that in the context of relationships, that when we do talk a little bit about this in terms of how pain is shared and how emotions can be shared. And it does come with great payouts and great benefits to be able to better name and express the emotions and the states that you are feeling. And, you know, we all know this from being in relationships with other people, with ourselves, like if my husband comes in and I'm just grumpy, like, which happens a lot, it happens a lot more lately, but you know, that's not helpful for our relationship. It's not helpful for him, because all I am is just this thing that he has to then react to. I'm just grumpy because I can't express why I'm grumpy. And usually what he does is then give me a glass of water or something to eat. And then I feel a little bit better and I'm a little bit less grumpy. So luckily he's figured out that part of our relationship. But it's part of having a healthy relationship with yourself. And I think with the other people around you, to be able to have this kind of emotional vocabulary and to talk about what's happening.
Yeah. And definitely a big, you know, some pain just is just the worst. It's awful. Yes. And it is unbearable, and it is just soul sucking, and, you know, can be just really, yes, really horrible. So, you know, it's not that, you know, we're saying that all pain can kind of be, taken away. It's that we have all of these tools that we can use to better, manage it and understand ourselves and be more compassionate towards ourselves. You know, I know that when I was in a lot of the nerve pain, I would get angry. I would get angry at myself. And in learning how to just show more compassion for my own body, I felt less pain. And there's a real neurophysical foundation for that too, just how stress and fear and anger and all of that kind of works up into a tornado of, you know, activation of our sympathetic nervous system and just increases the all of the kind of tension and that can contribute to then making pain, the intensity, worse. So just learning how to kind of calm that. And a lot of that comes through acceptance, just accepting mm-hmm. that it sucks right now. But it won't suck mm-hmm. later.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we talk a little bit in the book too, but being able to support other people going through that experience of pain is really, really hard. And it is a skill that has to be learned. I mean, one of the things that we found quite a lot of the people that we were talking to who had been in chronic pain, and a lot of the research demonstrates that people who are in chronic pain often report not being believed, not only by doctors and caregivers, but also by their loved ones and their friends and their family. And you know, one of the books that we read that I found sort of most affecting was by a 19th century French writer called Alphonse Daudet, and it's called In the Land of Pain. And he was in the last stages of neurosyphilis, which is an incredibly painful degenerative relapse of syphilis infection. And it happens decades after the initial infection. You think you're cured and all these things. And it's really, really painful. And he talked about the sadness, seeing the boredom in his loved one's eyes and hating himself for being a burden on them and the frustration. And it's such a sort of sad and affecting read because it feels so current. It feels exactly like the kind of thing that someone would write now. But there are some really important sort of bright spots from this, including when he found other people who were experiencing the same things that he was, and which is in part why the internet has been so great for people dealing with chronic or unusual conditions, because they can find people that they can connect with, the people who can not only sympathize, but also empathize for what they're going through. But it does mean that, you know, when there's just a lot of it's hard to support people going through pain and seeing loved ones in pain, not being able to do anything about it. And that's something that needs a lot of support and needs a lot of honesty, and it needs help. I mean, it's a hard thing to do.
That was going to be one of my questions, actually. How can we support loved ones? Is that something that you've focused on in the book, or are there things that may help people, takeaways that may help people with that?
Believing them is probably one of the first places to start. Mm.
And really so much more attention in the training of healthcare professionals. You know, it's glaring how absent a lot of specific just focus on training doctors and all healthcare practitioners how to manage pain, how to approach and treat patients who are reporting pain. And there's so much bias, just, you know, the discrimination by race, ethnicity, religion, gender, sexual orientation, all of that goes into how a healthcare professional is going to understand a patient in pain. And those biases come through and they make the pain even worse. You know, we interviewed a number of people who shared their experiences in the healthcare, you know, facilities, and just how devastating it is to not only go in intense pain, but then have healthcare professionals who are immediately going to stereotype you as drug seeking, or you know, a profound influence on how one of our interviewees was treated was whether she went to the emergency room alone or with her wife. You know, that, you know, just going into a emergency room with someone else communicates to everyone that, you know, you are a person worthy of love. And there's this stigma against people who come in alone. And, you know, that just adds on to the intensity of suffering in that moment. And so I think that, yeah, listening, like Linda said, and really just the increased awareness in the general population that we do have these biases that influence how we understand other people in pain, and we should be challenging those biases and, you know, more sensitive to other people's pain.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that I know that I have struggled with in relationships with other people is frankly that believing them. And I know that's a really terrible thing to sort of say and admit, but I think it's true that because I don't have their body, I'm not in their body. When someone, even people that I love, say, you know, say my husband has a cold, this has definitely happened, where I've been like, you're not that sick, you're fine, get up, get off the couch, help me do this thing, because and I just need to recognize that, like, it will be my turn to have the cold at some point, and I will be the one on the couch, and I will need his help and all those things. And that's sort of part of this pact, this relationship that we have, is that I support him through that bad stuff and he supports me through the bad stuff. But I also just need to, like, check myself, because frankly, like, who am I to tell him that he is not experiencing the thing that he is experiencing? Like, that's not fair on my part to say to him, you're fine. Like, cause you're not, maybe he's not. And, you know, I've noticed that as well with my children, that, like, if I really have to stop myself from saying to them, if they've bumped their heads or something like that, you're fine, because that tells them that their pain isn't valuable, that their pain isn't important, that I'm dismissing it. And we know from writing this book and just sort of lived experience that when you dismiss someone else's pain, it causes a lot of damage. It makes that pain worse, and it can cause some real sort of lifelong situations and lifelong anxiety around the experience of pain that doesn't need to be there. And so I think when I say believing them, it is really about allowing someone to experience pain and saying, yes, that is painful. That is a painful thing that you are dealing with right now.
Mm. Yeah. We have a chapter on, you know, kids in pain, and just how important it is to, you know, as Linda said, let them experience what they're experiencing. And, you know, it's a matter of not telling them, you know, that they're fine, or not telling them that they're, that they shouldn't be crying, or that they should just shrug it off, but, you know, asking them to, it's an opportunity for them to learn more about what their body is saying. And it's important for kids to have painful experiences so that they can, you know, learned that they will be okay, that they, you know, can break their arm and get back up and it not be a, you know, a traumatizing experience. A lot of the patterns that lead to how we deal with pain are set in those first critical years of life. And it doesn't mean that you're locked into that relationship, but you know, our relationship with pain is set pretty early in life. And so it is important for kids to have those opportunities where they push themselves, they take a risk. And it's, again, all about context. It has to be in the context of, you know, of play, of, you know, saying, I think I can run and jump and make it, and falling and knowing that they can get back up is just a really important part of learning resiliency, but then also that they can manage pain.
Yeah, it sounds like when someone's going through pain, like what they want the most is just to be validated and to really be seen. And sometimes people don't want a solution. They don't need you to tell them, you know, how they can fix it. It's just like, you know, being held in that moment when you're feeling hurt, feeling pain, whatever form that pain is. I think there's nothing more beautiful to really be seen in your most vulnerable moment.
Yeah.
And pain is one of those experiences that really strips away so much of the kinds of, you know, I don't know, the veneer, the walls, the layers, all the things that we put up. And being with someone in that moment, I mean, we do actually talk about pain as a bonding experience. And now, of course, we also address the sort of more fun aspects of, I suppose, pain in relationships. And we do have a bit of a section on BDSM and those and practices like that. So, but what's important to us is that we talk about that those represents those practices represent opportunities to explore physical and emotional sensations in ways without judgment that might bring you pleasure, might pain, but will definitely or could bring you closer to the people around you. And these are new experiences or potentially new experiences that can be encountered without judgment. And that's really important.
Oh, this is so fascinating. So interesting. Are there any final words that you would love to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
I think something that, you know, is so critical in understanding and managing fear is also so critical in pain is just that the agency and control, you know, our experience of pain really flows from how much control we feel we have in any given situation. And so to, you know, develop good relationships with pain, usually it has to happen within the context of choice, of exploration, and the pain that is not our choice, the pain that we feel we have no control over. That is the, you know, that is the worst kind of pain. And, it's just, I think that piece of context, control, and agency is just so crucial. And one of the very cool things that we did find is that finding ways to increase a person's sense of agency, in their pain, especially, you know, with chronic pain, to just find ways to remind them that they are, you know, this is their body, it is their pain, to gain a sense of greater control just can go a long way in reducing the intensity of pain. And on the other side of that, of course, pain that is not of our choosing, you know, traumatic incidents, and that is the pain that, you know, leaves not only physical damage, but the lasting, you know, emotional challenges as well. But you know, there's always hope, and we talk about lots of ways to grow from trauma and from pain.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we really thought about and really encountered is that, that, you know, a lot of articles and media reporting and things like that, like to throw around words like hardwired and stuff like that. And that's just not really accurate. We are plastic. We are able to change. We are able to change our behavior and to change, to adapt and to shape our responses to our environment, to things around us. And we have a measure of control over that, such that if we want to, we can exercise more control over how we experience these things.
Mm. Amazing. So inspiring. And I can't wait to read the book. It's coming out on the 21st of Jan, and it's actually going to be the day that this podcast will be out there into the world. So it'll be an exciting day when this comes out. Where can people find the book?
Well, here in the UK, it is available for pre-order on Amazon. You can also find it at really anywhere.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, wherever fine books are sold. But I don't know how that sounds. But yeah, you can pre-order it off at Amazon for sure. And it's also available through Bloomsbury's site. I hope it helps.
Then in the US, it will be available in March. It's available for pre-order right now through, I believe it's bookshop.org for people looking for indie options. And I'm sure lots more information for US publication dates will be in the works and to come.
And we will add the links to the show notes for people to grab that.
Sure. Thank you.
Linda and Margie, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. I really loved our conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So much. It was really fun.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.